Hello, I'm Andrew Tarkin. You're listening to The Urbanist on Monocle 24. Now, we've decided to kick off the new year with the very best from 2018.
Hardly any visitor will go more than a few hours without desperately seeking a moment of quiet inside one of the city's frondy retreats.
We take a look back at the best tall stories from the year gone by, including a thriving garden in the middle of the desert and a former government building in Oslo with a Picasso on its facade. All that and much more in the next 30 minutes with me, Andrew Tuck. Stay tuned. We start our tour through some of the best tall stories of the past year in Morocco. During spring, Monocle's Chiara Rimella took us to Marrakech to reveal the secret behind its plant-filled courtyards. And as we found out, this city in the middle of the desert could become a haven for gardens such as the peaceful Jardin Secret.
The road from Marrakech to the Atlas Mountains is about 50 kilometres long. It's an hour's drive, more or less, and one that zooms almost straight through a rosy, rocky desert. Seen from any of the city's flat rooftops, these mighty mountains may well look like a mirage. With their snowy tips, they seemingly belong continents away from the baking heat of the Medina. Yet there they stand, proudly, close enough to provide more than just an escape from unbearably sunny days. What the Atlas have given Marrakech easy access to for the last millennium is a far more important resource, water. Without it, the city would not be very different from the barren land which surrounds it. But inside its courtyards and within its palace's walls, Marrakech hides palms, plants and flowers that stubbornly defy the dry terrain. Marrakech's gardens define this city just as much as its maze-like roads. Hardly any visitor will go more than a few hours without desperately seeking a moment of quiet inside one of the city's frondy retreats. Outside, people, scooters, children on bikes constantly rush through stalls laden with pomegranates, bread and all manner of vegetables. They whiz past shop fronts covered in plates, teapots and tourist tat. But inside the gardens, the noise stops. Not much other than the rustle of the wind and the soft pouring of a fountain disturbs a sit-down in the shade of a patio. It was only because of the proximity of the Atlas Mountains that the imperial Almoravid dynasty decided to bring a system of irrigation to Marrakech. The first Kettara, a network of underground tunnels and wells, was built in 1107 to transport water from the aquifer underneath the mountains all the way to the city's only garden. Residents were ecstatic. The water, they said, gave the city an air of sparkling brilliance. More Kettaras were added, more gardens planted. An atmosphere of sophistication spread through the city. The system eventually grew to feed the city's mosques, public hammams and fountains. But for centuries, having water flow into the grounds of a private home remained a prestigious privilege and an unmistakable symbol of wealth. Only Marrakech's richest were able to afford it, families like those who would come to inhabit the grandiose palace on Rue Mouassine in the 19th century. One of the biggest in the whole Medina, this majestic riad had two courtyards, a hammam of its own, and a vast dome pavilion. At 17 metres tall, its tower was almost as high as some of the city's minarets. But perhaps most importantly, it had a magnificent garden. Its owner, the Qaid Al-Aj Abd Allah Ubihi, didn't get to enjoy it very long. Suspected of political intrigue, he was killed with poisoned tea. His beautiful home started passing from one powerful hand to the other until in 1934 it stopped being looked after at all. By 2008, it had turned into a melancholy ruin. Only a few stubborn date plants still grew in its grounds. Yet life was not to stop flowing in these gardens. That same year, British landscape architect Tom Stuart Smith was called in to rethink and restore them. And 8 long years later, the house finally reopened its doors with a new name, Le Jardin Secret, the secret garden. Everything from stuccos to tiles and walls was spruced up, but the two courtyards returned the house's deservedly central feature. The so-called exotic garden was to host plants sourced anywhere from Mexico to Madagascar. The traditional Islamic garden instead brought in Morocco's aromatic bounty. Lavender, rosemary, fig, olive and orange trees were chosen for this section. And even if the narrow channels running through these manicured patches no longer carry water flowing in from the Atlas, the system running between these basins is still the same ancient one of the building's beginnings. If you look hard enough in some of the Riyadh's nooks and crannies, you'll spot the pipes and reservoirs that still ensure these plants can survive in Marrakesh's boiling summers. Perhaps theirs is, really, these gardens' biggest and most fascinating secret.
Monocle's Chiara Romella there in Marrakesh. Stay with us. After this, it's my turn to head south. Well, just south of the Thames, here in London. It's the story of a brutalist wonder built by the architect Sir Denis Lasdon. London's National Theatre is perfection in concrete. It's a work of the architect Sir Denis Lasdon and was completed in 1976. But this tall story is not about the recent fetishization of brutalism. It's not about the power of theatre. Well, not only, nor the role of the South Bank in London's cultural life. It's about light, touch, dark, sanctuary, and rare focus, and perhaps an ice cream in the interval if you're good. I've been going to the National for 3 decades and have seen Shakespeare, Sondheim and numerous star turns. I've mostly seen things that I've loved, occasionally plays that have been sleep-inducing, and sometimes a play that shakes you.
Against a sea of troubles.
But there is something about that theatre that, no matter the quality of the production, just makes you feel good, safe and away from the world.
It begins with me leaving my house or work and crossing over Waterloo Bridge to reach the theatre. You have to turn your back on the city, cross the muddy depths of the Thames, and leave at least some of the day behind.
And then down some pissy stairs, and there you are on the broad South Bank promenade, where life somehow unfolds at a more leisured pace, whether that's walking locked-armed seniors or foot-pumping skateboarders. Then into the National's vast lobby, where lip-staining red wine and flapjacks are being consumed by an eclectic crowd that crosses ages but rarely looks done up for a night out. Let's join them in a glass as we see the sun slink down through the epic windows. Tonight we're seeing a play in the National Theatre's Littleton space, and here are those nice upholstered seats that you know so well. There's just time to eye the crowd and guess at their lives when not united here. Then, phones off, lights down, and... Well, tonight is a performance of Network and the story of the news anchor who gets angry. But there's something else. The fuck of a day is eased off like a discarded jacket. People begin to laugh and move with a gentle synchronicity. And you? You're in a different world. Your mind finds a rare reset to clarity. You are here, and in the dark, all is good. In May, our Asia Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson took us to the very heart of Tokyo to tell us the story of the Suzuki Honganji, a Buddhist temple right next to what was one of the world's biggest fish markets, which has sadly packed up and moved elsewhere in the meantime. Let's listen in.
If you were trying to picture a traditional Japanese temple, it probably wouldn't look anything like Tsukiji Honganji. And yet this Buddhist temple in the heart of Tokyo is rich in history. The story of Tsukiji Honganji starts in 1617, when the head of the mother temple in Kyoto established a branch temple in Asakusa in Tokyo, or Edo as it was known then. Like so many buildings, that first temple went up in flames in the Great Fire of 1657. And when it came to rebuilding, the shoguns had other plans for the site and offered the temple instead a damp plot of land on the shore, which had yet to be reclaimed from the sea. The project was undertaken by the temple's devoted followers, and the new building, which was finished in 1679, was known as Tsukiji Gobo, Tsukiji meaning reclaimed land. That area is still known as Tsukiji, and it is here that the temple still stands, next to the world's biggest fish market. The main hall that was built for Honganji on the Tsukiji site had a huge sloping roof that was one of Old Edo's great landmarks and a beacon for ships entering the port of Tokyo. That building was destroyed in the Great Kanto earthquake of 1923 and was replaced in 1934 with the current building, a striking temple designed by Chuta Ito, an architecture professor at Tokyo University. The abbot asked Ito to build something inspired by India, the birthplace of Buddhism. So today, Tsukiji Honganji has all the features of a regular Japanese temple, the main hall, the bell tower, the drum tower, and so on, but in an unusual guise, borrowing motifs from South Asian temples. It has a round copper-covered roof, granite walls, carved elephants on the staircases, and monkeys on the walls. The hybrid style continues with lotus flowers and stained glass above the door, and a German-made organ with 2,000 pipes that was donated to the temple in 1970. The temple is a lively place of worship, open every day from 6 a.m. The smell of incense is unmissable, and if you drop by in the morning, you might catch a service with 24 monks chanting. Visitors are encouraged to take a seat. Tsukiji Honganji is an important centre of Buddhist learning. Its style of Buddhism is called Jodo Shinshu, or True Pure Land Buddhism, and dates back to the 13th century. Today, Jodo Shinshu is one of the largest schools of Buddhism in Japan, with more than 10,000 temples. Last year, a new information centre and a Buddhist bookshop were added with a smart new cafe. The deluge of tourists now flocking to the fish market has increased the numbers of visitors to Honganji too. Guests are welcomed warmly, and services are held in English on the fourth Saturday of every month, a rarity in Tokyo. Lunchtime organ concerts feature everything from classical pieces to Buddhist songs and are free to all. Many visitors come out of Tsukiji Station and make a beeline for the famous fish market. But if they pause for a moment, they'll discover there is another piece of Tokyo history right in front of them.
Now, if you're a regular listener to Monocle 24, you'll know that we've just opened a new bureau in Los Angeles. So with that in mind, let's take you back to La La Land for this tall story. Proudly sitting in the downtown area of LA, the Walt Disney Concert Hall is hard to miss. In the shape of ships and sails, the 3.5-acre complex may fool you at first with its sharp, imposing stainless steel edges, but once inside, the tone is changed and the hall becomes warm and inviting. Opening its doors in 2003, 16 years after its initial commission, we hear how the construction of the concert hall was anything but plain sailing.
Welcome to the Music Center and our Walt Disney Concert Hall. My name is Howard Sherman. I'm the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer here. I also have the privilege of being the unofficial historian of the Music Center because I've been here for more than 30 years and have a deep-seated love for this place. Lillian Disney, Walt's widow, gave a transformative $50 million cash gift to the Music Center in the late 1980s, with the understanding that this would build the fourth theater of the Music Center, a home for the LA Philharmonic and the LA Master Chorale, which would be acoustically perfect and represent Mrs. Disney's love of gardens. After an international search for an architect, Frank Geary, although Canadian, we like to call him our homegrown Angelino because he's lived in Los Angeles for so long, won the competition and became the architect of Walt Disney Concert Hall.
It's Thursday, April 30th, 1992. World News This Morning continues with Mike Schneider.
Good morning to you once again. Our top story this morning comes from Los Angeles following the verdict in the four police officers who were accused in the beating of the motorist Rodney King. They were found not guilty of almost all the charges, and one charge
in the Channel 7 newsroom. There has been a major earthquake in Southern California. We are getting reports of lots of damage to the buildings and the roadways. There are reports of widespread power outages, gas leaks, and landslides.
The competition was won. Frank designed the building. And then in the 90s, we had the earthquake, we had the riots after the Rodney King verdict, and the city sort of came to an economic halt. The county of Los Angeles had committed to and completed the garage on which Walt Disney Concert Hall would be built, and then everything stopped because fundraising needed to happen. Although the Disney gift was incredibly generous and the largest gift of its kind at the time, between escalation, time moving forward, and the brilliance of Frank Gehry's design, obviously more money was going to be needed to be raised. So ultimately, after the economic downturn sort of subsided, a trio of three incredible leaders, the mayor at the time, Richard Reardon, Eli Brode, who's a well-known Los Angeles philanthropist, and Andrea Van de Kamp, who was chairman of the board of the Music Center at the time, said, "We have to fix this. LA has to come back, and the symbol of its resurrection will be the building of Walt Disney Concert Hall." Construction began. We raised $247 million to complete the building of this building. And in October of 2003, it opened. Heralded as an architectural success, acoustically, it's been lauded throughout the world as being one of the most perfect halls to perform in. In fact, there are many artists who are terrified of performing in this hall because it is so acoustically perfect that it's fairly unforgiving. And if you're not at the top of your game, you'll hear that you're not at the top of your game because there is no hiding what you do in this room. Shortly after the building opened, we realized that a very small portion of the building was causing a reflective glare into certain areas. 96% of the building is finished with a brushed stainless, but about 4% of the building is finished with a shiny reflective stainless, and naturally that's what was causing the problems. We did a complete study with UCLA doing a sun positioning study, looking at where the sun was in relation to the shiny surfaces of the concert hall over a 365-day period. We then determined which of the panels were absolutely the most egregious, causing the reflection, and then worked with Frank Gehry to determine a system to dull just those specific panels. It was 1% of the building, it was like 40 or 50 panels that we needed to go ahead and do a hand-brushed treatment to. We invited the press, we did a whole big thing about it, and some of it is being good neighbors. We are downtown LA, and we are in what is rapidly becoming an incredibly residential area. So we want to respond to the neighborhood, and some of that was making sure that we weren't disturbing our neighbors by glare and reflection. When Mrs. Disney gave her gift, she said she wanted it to honor her husband, and she wanted two things in the hall. She wanted it to be acoustically perfect, and she wanted it to represent her love of gardens. So to that end, Frank brought in Dr. Toyota from the beginning to make sure the acoustics were right, but he also designed gardens that are hidden throughout the building. The third floor of this building has a complete exterior garden that wraps two sides of the building that when you are in, you are in a complete urban oasis. You have no idea you are in the middle of downtown Los Angeles. The designer designed the garden such that there was always something blooming. What you forget is that you are three stories up in the air and actually over all of the rehearsal spaces that are backstage at Walt Disney Concert Hall. I think my favorite spot in the hall is in the terrace view seats, which are one flight above the orchestra and behind the stage. On stage left and stage right, there are these idyllic little pods that are not expensive seats. And because of the acoustics of the building, the sound is the same everywhere. So wherever you sit in that room, you're going to have the same experience. But if you sit in those terrace view seats, you get a view of the conductor, you get a view of the audience, and you get a view of this magnificent room for creating performance. And because of my unique position, when it's empty, It's also the most reflective place at the Music Center to sit and think and reflect on the good, the bad, the ugly, the day, the problems. And that's probably my favorite place in the building.
That was Howard Sherman, Executive Vice President and COO of the Music Center, and our special thanks to Sam Impey for that report. Now it's almost time for us to wrap up our grand tour of the very best tour stories of 2018. But before we do, there's time for one more. It's the story of a former government building in Oslo, left in limbo since the 2011 terrorist attacks in Norway. Called the Y-block due to its shape, the building's future is now up for debate, with many believing it should be demolished. But there's a strong case in favour of its architectural value, mainly due to the large mural on its facade, designed by Pablo Picasso. Our design editor, Nolan Giles, explains it all.
On a snowy winter's day last year, I found myself trudging through Oslo's city centre. When I saw a building of such a striking nature, I was halted in my tracks. A curved concrete brutalist structure, some five stories high, wrapped its way around a quiet corner of the city centre. With a nod to the 1950s built UNESCO headquarters in Paris, and more than a hint of the Le Corbusier style thrown into the design mix, I knew I was staring at a modernist marvel. On closer inspection, the meticulous detail of its architectural makeup became more apparent. The concrete that clambered around wooden window frames was given warmth via a rich pebble dash texture, and on one facade stood a giant fresco. In a simple, line-drawn style, it was unmistakably a work of, or a work very much inspired by, Pablo Picasso, and it scaled right up into the sky. Humbled by my discovery, I dashed to my appointment with a Norwegian architect, who revealed that indeed the mural, featuring local fishermen casting their nets into the sea, was Picasso's, and the building itself, known as Y-blocker, or Y-block, was formerly part of the HQ of the Norwegian government, an architectural masterpiece from the nation's modernist era by Erling Viksja. But why were the windows all boarded up, I asked, and where were the hordes of architectural appreciators snapping its fine walls on their phones? And then I learned the tragic story of Viksja's and Picasso's masterpiece. In 2011, just 1 month after a government consensus was reached to preserve the 1960s building and its sister building, the H Block, the car bomb attack that marked the start of the nation's most horrific terrorist incident ripped through the two buildings.
It all started around 3:30 on a quiet Friday afternoon in Oslo, the capital of Norway. Explosions from a car bomb rocked several government buildings, including the offices of the Prime Minister, killing at least seven people and injuring dozens more.
The bomb killed eight of the 77 people who were murdered in the bloodiest day in Norway's history since the Second World War. While both buildings were left structurally sound, security fears and the haunting memory of that day are two of the reasons why the Y Block will soon meet the wrecking ball, as the Norwegian government plans to rebuild a new HQ on this site. But many in Oslo and far beyond are fighting back for the Y Block, and when you dig a little deeper into its architectural history, it's obvious why they're doing this. Despite those more conventionally minded seeing the building as a bit of a brute, its design is in fact a true homage to the nature of Norway. That pebble-dash concrete, so warm in character, was in fact a material pioneered by Viksja, which he called his natural concrete. And it features thousands of small stones gathered from the nation's streams and rivers. The material's contrast against the sand-blasted elements, which were designed to be used as giant canvases for artistic works, is so beautiful that when Picasso first saw pictures of the proposal, he dashed straight out to his garden, elated, to show his gardener just what could be achieved with concrete. It's a building of art and architecture, and Viksja even took reference from the storied staved churches of Norway in its design. These timber churches managed to be both marvelously ornate and practical in form. And when Picasso asked the architect how long his building was going to last, the reply was about 1,000 years. After all, Some of these staved timber churches are still standing, despite being older than 1,000 years. But while people like Siri Hume from the Society for the Preservation of Norwegian Ancient Monuments and other local action groups continue to raise awareness for this building's profound design, plans to destroy it motor ahead. There will be at least a concerted effort to somehow preserve the giant Picasso mural from the building. Yet this work's real value was in bringing both artist and architect together to create something more powerful than both of their disciplines could muster individually. To simply chop the mural off the building and place it somewhere else as a monument would be a disservice to both Picasso and Vikscha. Today, pressure mounts quickly on governments in reaction to terrorism to offer safe solutions for citizens, and these decisions are not always the best ones for the city. The Y block can no longer be seen as a safe building, but the debate surrounding its destruction points to one of the greatest challenges of our city planners. Those in office need to make us feel safe in our cities, but maintain urban fabrics that give us a sense of place, highlight history, and promote the civic pride we all crave.
And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and was edited by David Stevens. And to pay you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Flatland Cavalry with Tall City Blues. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
Well, I hate this time, hate this place. There ain't nothing to do. Said go down to the bar each night and drink till two. I hate my job. I'm always in a bad mood. I fear I'm